What's going on? Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It is heard live every day from noon to 3 on WBT Radio in Charlotte. And if you want exclusive content, like invitations to events, the weekly live stream, my daily show prep with all the links, become a patron, go to thepetecallinershow.com. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, get every episode for free, right to your smartphone or tablet. And again, thank you so much for your support. The North Carolina legislature scrambling. It's a flurry of activity today. They are trying to wrap up as much business as they can. They haven't done a budget yet. Stop. Silly questions. They're still hung up on that. I'm going to get to that. But there's a legislation that has been approved and is moved in the House and the Senate today because they're trying to clear as much of this as they can ahead of what could be several months off, maybe even through the election. So we'll see. So a couple things here. I'm just going to read from the in case you are on Twitter and you are interested in following North Carolina politics, there are two hashtags that you want to follow. Or you just follow me, and I usually will send out the most important stuff. But there, what a hashtag is, for folks who don't know, you put the little number sign, little pound sign, and then you put a word or an abbreviation, an acronym of some kind, and that will aggregate all of the topics that people post with those hashtags. So it's a sorting, it's a filtering mechanism. Okay, and it's public; everybody can see it. So if you type in the search bar on Twitter, hashtag NCPOL, all one word, NCPOL, then you'll get North Carolina politics. Now, the NCGA hashtag, North Carolina General Assembly, hashtag NCGA, all one word, that is more of like the policy stuff that you'll see there. People do try to keep it clean from a lot of the political partisan clutter. Usually there are some offenders, but you could just, you know, mute them or block them. But where the wet work occurs, the knifing of each other and stuff, that occurs on the NCPOL, North Carolina Politics hashtag. So you could follow those, and it's a pretty good way to keep up with stuff that's moving, because a lot of reporters, operatives, elected officials, they will be posting on these hashtags when stuff gets done. So here's a tweet from Michael Hyland. He is with WNCN. I don't know if it matters what the channel is. It doesn't matter. It's in Raleigh. Anyway, he says that the House has voted unanimously to put, this is just the House, to put an amendment on the ballot in November to repeal the literacy test from the North Carolina Constitution. And that's now going to go over to the Senate for concurrence. For their approval, I should say. They have to approve that as well. So in the state constitution, there's a literacy test provision. This would remove it, which I'm kind of surprised Democrats didn't do it when they were in control for a century and a half. Well, okay, now, to be fair, much of that time was spent enforcing and passing Jim Crow laws. So, okay, so maybe not the whole 150 years that they were in power, maybe just like the last 30. Still, kind of surprised they never got around to that before 2010. But now the Republicans are in charge, and they're wanting to put this up to voters to repeal the literacy test from the state constitution. Like I said, it goes over to the Senate for a vote over there. Next up, Brian Anderson. He says that by a 66-45 vote, the North Carolina House has approved a bill that would require the State Board of Elections to use data provided by election integrity groups to make corrections to the voter rolls. The Board of Elections would then provide quarterly reports to lawmakers on what corrections were made and how many sorted by county. Outrage has ensued. How dare you try to clean up the voter rolls? Right? That's what the Democrats are mad about. Ooh, is this a... Okay. So, this is from our friend Andy Jackson, Dr. Jackson at the John Locke Foundation. He says, this is House Bill 1071, a voter roll purge bill they're calling it, that the Democrats are, that requires the Board of Elections to cooperate with voter integrity groups to, quote, purge voter rolls. And he says, by the way, voter list maintenance is not a purge. It's not, that's not, you're not purging voters that are legitimate voters. It's list maintenance. You have to keep up with the list maintenance. You got to have good lists. Otherwise, people who are dead, for example, right? People could vote in their name if you don't maintain your lists. People who move out of state and the Board of Elections doesn't update their lists. If you don't vote in, I forget what the rule is. It may be like four presidential election or three or no, two, maybe two presidential election cycles. So 8 years. If you don't vote in 8 years, I think they bounce you off the list. I forget what the exact number is, though, but the list maintenance is designed in order to safeguard the election. So this way, because look, I can go to the Board of Elections website and I can, if I know your name, I can find out your voter history. People don't realize this. In North Carolina, you can pull anyone's voter card and you, if you know their name, and you can find their voting history, not how they voted, but you can see whether they voted. And when people vote in a particular way, like, for example, if you're you're an A voter, as they used to call it, A voter, which is you vote in all of the local elections, you vote in all the primaries, and you vote in the presidential general elections every 4 years. You're an A voter. B voters, they don't vote as often. They may just be voting in presidential election years. You know, the big general elections, they're not voting in primaries. And then like C voters, they're only voting like every 4 years in the presidential race, and that's it. Right. So they can tell. I can tell. Anybody can tell. And the and political organizations, the parties, campaigns. Right. They can get this data in a big old zip file. They can download it all and then they can sort it out with their computer programs and such. And then they can target people who haven't voted. That's why, like during the Obama campaign of 08, people were in awe of how well they had mastered the computational powers of the internet and such, and they were able to target people who had not voted, and then as soon as they voted, they would just cease all communications, because that's just a waste of time and money and manpower to keep hitting people after they've already voted. Right? That's how they know you voted. Every single day during a campaign, the lists are produced of who voted. And so the campaigns can take that data and then move along and start going after people who have not voted yet and to try to get them to vote. And that's why early voting has become so important, is that you can spend 2 weeks or, you know, 20 days, whatever it is, hitting people, getting their votes, banking the votes, and then focusing your efforts on the people who have not voted yet. But here's the thing. They also know, if you don't have a history of voting, but you're registered, well, they can go vote for you. They know your information. It's right there on the, but now you need the voter ID. Ah, see? That throws a monkey wrench in all of this, right? That's why the voter ID was so important, was because you could just walk in, and if I have, you know, your address, your name, and I just say, I'm you, and I live at this address, and then they would give me a ballot, and I would go vote. And then they would count it. And now later they may go back and be like, oh, hey, two people, like, because then you would show up to vote on the rare occasion, and it's like, oh, somebody already voted in your name. And they've been voting in your name for years. This actually happened in this state to a candidate for office. She was registered to vote up in New York, and somebody had been casting votes up there. She says it wasn't her. Right? She says it wasn't her, but yet she was voting in New York. And the guy up in New York that runs the Suffolk County Long Island elections office up there, he said it's basically an honor system. See, that's why these interstate compacts are so important, is to share the information. So the elections offices, state to state, county to county, know that the person identified by like the last four digits of their social security number, their name, their address, date of birth, that kind of stuff. And you can cross check that. That was actually the name of the program. It was called the Interstate Cross Check. And so they wanted all of the states to do these cross checks to make sure that people weren't going back and forth between states and voting, because people have done that. There was a couple of years ago, there was a guy busted. He had voted in like three different states out in Western North Carolina. So it does happen. List maintenance is a way to safeguard against that. Voter ID is not a cure-all for every kind of vote fraud. It is one measure. It's one measure. And if you believe in the democracy, then you should want voter integrity measures put in place. And that means list maintenance. So I'm okay with purging lists of people that are not active voters anymore, because it limits the potential that people are going to use that information to vote in your stead when you are an inactive voter. What else is going on up there? Why did I do that? I just closed out the... Oh, hang on a second. Reopen closed tab, because I just closed it on accident. I did not mean to do that, because there was one other thing that that occurred up in Raleigh. Come on, back up. I know this is fascinating radio. I know. Andy Jackson. They removed two constitutional amendments that we otherwise would have, had they passed, you know, we'll see them. Now, they may come back, I don't know. But there's one for requiring voter ID for every voter. And the other, and that means like the absentee, this is for constitutional amendment votes from today's calendar. The proposals on requiring voter ID for every voter and changing the appointment process for members of the Council of State. Those two got removed. The Associated Press story by Gary Robertson and Micaiah Seminara. The North Carolina General Assembly raced yesterday to advance legislation before completing its chief working session for the year, even as lawmakers know they could return later this summer to settle unfinished business, aka the budget. The to-be-continued work likely includes adjustments to the second year of the budget. While House and Senate Republicans have moved competing spending measures for the fiscal year that begins next week, talks have broken down on working out their differences. Senate Leader Phil Berger said that his chamber is poised to leave Raleigh after today, and House Speaker Tim Moore has said that a little cooling off might be in order. So, doesn't look like there's going to be a budget deal, but who knows? One bill... The General Assembly is looking to override some of the governor's vetoes. They have already voted to override three. One, increases punishments for people wearing masks while committing a crime and for blocking a road during a demonstration. And the left is apoplectic about this. They seem to think that they need to wear the masks all the time or else they're going to die, I think. There's this performative element to all of this stuff that I just have no patience for, really. You know? And I say that as one who makes a living being informative and entertaining. So I recognize the value of, you know, solid performance. But, like, when you're drawing pictures of the masks and saying, you know, over my dead body or from my cold dead hands will you get this, or, you know, don't tread on me with the mask, like, guys, it's a mask, all right? And if you want to go riot, you can't wear a mask. That's the point here. You can't wear these medical looking masks claiming that you're trying to stop the spread of communicable diseases while you're criming, okay? Like, that's the deal. So that was one of them, the veto override, wearing a mask while committing a crime. And the other is blocking a road during a demonstration. Overridden. Another bill allows for people to wear medical or surgical grade masks to prevent spreading illnesses. But police and property owners This is the same bill, but it's a different measure inside the bill is what he says here, the measure. It still allows you to wear the mask to prevent spreading illness, but police and property owners, so if I own the store and you come into my store and I'm like, I want to see your face, you got to take it off. You got to remove that for identification purposes.
No!
Yes. Yes, you do. A slew of proposed constitutional amendments that could appear on the ballot in November, depending on how the legislature acts. If approved by a simple majority of voters, these amendments become law. So one of them requires 72 House and 30 Senate members' votes to get them on the ballot, and the governor does not have veto power over these. Okay, of the four proposals moving through the House or Senate, two have gotten the most traction. One clarifies that only U.S. citizens can vote and that photo identification is required for all types of voting, not just for in-person balloting. Okay, that's the one that got removed. Okay? That's the one I think that got sidelined, the photo ID one. There's a Senate version, includes a Third Amendment proposal that would cap state income tax rate at 5%. Remember, we just went through a constitutional amendment that set the maximum state income tax at 7%. And the left went nuts.
Well, we might need to raise taxes a whole lot.
They, yeah. It used to be, originally it was 7%. And then it got boosted to 10%. Under Democrats, and then the Republicans got into power and they just reduced it via a constitutional amendment voted on by us. You might call it the democracy. We voted to cap it at 7%. Well, the Senate wants to revise that now and come back to us and say, hey, how would you like it to be 5%? And me, I would be totally on board with that too. Another House amendment would limit the governor's appointment power when filling Council of State vacancies. This one also got punted, at least today, for the time being. It could come back. The governor, under the amendment, if approved, the governor would be required to choose from a list of three nominees provided by the state party that the vacating official was affiliated with when elected. So, in other words, if, let's say, right now you've got Dale Falwell, he's the state treasurer. If he were to step aside, then what the amendment would be to force, you know, the state party to offer three names up to the governor, and then the governor would have to pick from those names. And they would come from the same political party. But I don't know if that's going to go anywhere. Apparently today it got sidelined, at least temporarily, maybe permanently, don't know yet. Okay, if you're listening to this podcast, you are obviously paying attention to the world around us. You also have really great taste, I might add. But if you haven't started getting prepared for various emergencies, I gotta ask, what are you waiting for? Please call my friends Bill and Jan at Carolina Readiness Supply, and they'll help get you started. If you have no idea how to start, they can help you. If you're an experienced prepper, they can help you too. Being prepared is just smart. We've already established that you're smart. I mean, you listen to this podcast after all. So let's put those smarts into action. Go to CarolinaReadiness.com. That's CarolinaReadiness.com or call them at 828-226-7239. Carolina Readiness Supply has 2,000 square feet of supplies as well as educational materials that you're going to need for any kind of emergency. Veteran-owned Carolina Readiness Supply. Will you be ready when the lights go out? We got another flag controversy. They're trying to make this appeal to heaven flag. They're trying to make this a thing, okay? This one's in North Carolina. I will. I'll get to that in a minute. First, let's get over to the. Let's go over to the WBT phones here and talk with Byron. Hello, Byron. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you?
Hey, I'm well. What's going on?
I picked up just a few minutes of the conversation. I think you were talking about things that were being considered in the state legislator. And are they considering the medical marijuana? And did you see the TV show about the Chinese in Oklahoma heavily involved in the growth of medical marijuana, which is legal? But, you know, maybe that's where a lot of these Chinese guys are going that come across the border.
And to work in the medical marijuana industry?
They own it. They run it. The huge facilities.
So the medical marijuana bill in North Carolina, it is it has the support in the Senate, but the Senate is they are trying to push the House to approve it. There is not enough votes, as we are told by the leadership. There's not enough votes to get it passed in the House, and so it's not moving in the House. And so that's part of the problem why there's no budget, is that they're basically holding the budget hostage on that, as well as the casino approval. More casinos for the state.
Yeah.
So that's the status of North Carolina. There's no movement on it, as far as I know, today on medical marijuana. As far as the Chinese ownership of the medical marijuana industry, I'm not aware of that. I did not see whatever story you're referring to, but I know that the North Carolina bill is not like they specifically have crafted a bill that tightly regulates the market, to the point where, like, some libertarians and conservatives are opposed to it because they don't like the fact that the state is taking such a heavy-handed regulatory approach to it. But the proponents of the legislation do not want to create a sort of circus-like haven for people to come to North Carolina and, I've got some, I have a pain in my back, and so therefore I get a prescription for pot. They don't want it to be sort of made a mockery of, like they say California and Colorado have done.
Well, my biggest concern, being a tobacco farmer, is the chemicals these people are using on these federal parklands and these, who knows what the Chinese are using or putting in it. And I'm wondering if the legislator have discussed that about them coming to North Carolina. That as part of the legalization in North Carolina, I would just be curious if they knew about all that and were discussing it. And, it needs to be regulated, just like alcohol. They're out there just like they had stills all over the country in federal parklands.
Mm-hmm. They still do, man. They still do, Byron.
Heavily armed.
Yeah, oh yeah, they still do have stills.
Well, sure. I grew up in Wilkes County, so there's a few still around.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so that stuff hasn't gone away. I mean, I think there's probably a lot fewer of them. Like, I myself have no need to buy moonshine because I can get whatever liquor I would prefer at the store. And
sure.
Yeah, like I don't have to worry about going blind drinking that. Sure. That's one of the benefits. I would encourage you to go look at the legislation, because it's very lengthy and they spell out the entire, and with your background and expertise, you may be able to understand a lot more of that process when it's described, because it's like they talk about everything from the growing all the way through the distribution. So you may get some of your questions answered if you look through the legislation on it.
Yes. Well, they need to be careful, because the chemicals that are put into this stuff is what really harms people. And in these places where it's grown unregulated, they got to really crack down on it. Cause it's,
are you talking about fentanyl?
Well, could be that. Could be anything.
Right. Well, because I know, like, that's been one of the criticisms of the tobacco industry, was that all of the stuff that's sprayed on the plants makes its way into the final product. And that's the stuff that's, pretty nasty. The tobacco in and of itself is one thing, but then you've got, like, pesticides that are applied and that sort of thing. And so then they add different things in the creation of their particular blend, right? So it's a lot of that other stuff that works its way in versus, weed, when you're growing it. As far as I know, like, there are not a lot of natural enemies to the marijuana plant as compared to the tobacco plant. Tobacco plant's got way more natural enemies, insects and stuff. So that's what I've heard. I've never run a grow operation, so I cannot confirm.
Yeah.
So, all right. Hey, man, I appreciate the call, Byron. Thanks so much. Good to hear from you. Let me see here. I got a couple of messages. Here's one from Tommy. He says, I moved back to North Carolina in January from South Carolina. Do you think my name is still in the South Carolina voter rolls? Maybe. I would recommend you check into that. I always recommend people check into it. Because sometimes, not trying to allege any kind of nefariousness or anything. Nefariousness? Nefarity? No. I'm not trying to allege any kind of malintent. I'm just, you know, sometimes stuff gets overlooked. People die and then like their kids go and check their parents' name in the voter rolls and find out, oh, they're still registered to vote. Like that kind of thing does happen. That's why the maintenance process is so important. Stan says on the state income tax cap, it was 10%. Then 7%. Now Democrats want it back at 10%. Well, I think Democrats would prefer it not be capped at all, because any number you put on it, like the argument they made last time around when we took it from 10% back to the original 7%, the arguments that they were making was, you know, if we have, you know, some sort of another great recession or a depression, then we're going to have to collect more taxes and all that. Well, there's no limiting principle on that position, right? Why then have any cap? If the fear is that you're going to need a whole boatload of more money, then why stop at 10%? This is the same argument with like the living wage arguments, right? And the minimum wage, like why stop at 15, right? Why not mandate everybody get paid $100 an hour and then nobody will be poor, right? Why? Because they do recognize that there is a limiting factor involved. They just don't want to articulate it. Back to the email, he says, Democrats want it back at 10%, probably even higher, to eventually reach 100% if they tell you their Marxist true intentions. So I have an idea. Why don't we propose 0%, like seven other states that, by the way, have booming economies, including Florida, Texas, and Tennessee? If they need more revenue, they can just raise the other, less intrusive to your liberties, taxes, even higher. They won't, because it's all about keeping that method of extracting or extorting money from us alive and well. Look, this, when I say this all the time, when it comes to taxation to fund government services, it's like a balloon, right? It's like a balloon, inflated and tied off. You can squeeze that balloon on one side, and then the other side's going to inflate higher. Squeeze it on the other side, and the other side's going to inflate higher. And you can go back and forth. People in Texas and in Florida, right, they make up their budgets not through an income tax, but through property taxes, sales taxes, right? These are the three main drivers of revenue generation for government. And so if you cut the income tax, fantastic. For people who make money, people who earn money, whether you're retired and you're not paying an income tax on that anymore because you're retired, like in Florida, right? Then that's going to benefit you. But now if you own property, well, you're going to get hit with a higher tax bill, because they've got to make up the revenue somehow. So the local property taxes in these states are much higher than what we pay in North Carolina, because it's sort of offset. And the other thing is, and that's why the legislature keeps doing the income tax rate reductions at sort of a gradual decline. They keep cutting the rate, because they don't want to shock the system, right? They're doing it gradually to move the economy one way or the other without jeopardizing like a massive budget shortfall, right? They don't want that to happen. So they are doing it gradually and see if it works, see how much revenue comes in, get a baseline, and then do another rate cut. And so that's what they've been doing for, gosh, now what, 10 years? Alrighty, so I'm supposed to be all upset, according to the people that are telling me that the sky is falling every single day, that a flag with connections to the J6 insurrection was spotted flying over a beach house owned by North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul Newby's wife. So Paul Newby's wife owns a beach house, or at least the house is in her name, at the beach. And the flag, called the Appeal to Heaven flag, or Pine Tree flag, has its roots in the Revolutionary War. Yes, in fact, it was commissioned by George Washington himself. It's become notable in recent years for its presence among rioters at the J6 insurrection and its connections to the Christian conservative movement. Probably because it says appeal to heaven, and George Washington was a pretty devout Christian, and you know, people at that time were Christians, and they were like appealing to heaven, you know, God help us win this fight, because otherwise we're all dead, you know, like that kind of thing. And so they had this flag, and it's one of the flags of our history. And it is always astounding to see how Democrats are so comfortable and eager to just sort of discard these icons and symbols of the American founding. And they just like turn it all over. It's like the Gadsden flag. I talked about this when the very same flag flew above San Francisco City. Oh, no, wait, that's right. They didn't care about that one. The Appeal to Heaven flag has flown outside of San Francisco City Hall for decades until the story came out that it was hoisted up over the house of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito, right? It was his wife who was a flag person. She loves the flags, and she has all these different flags. Alito, not so much. He doesn't really care about them. But oh my God, some people who were at the January 6th protest that turned into a riot, they were flying, they were carrying that flag around. And so you know what that means. Sorry, gonna have to throw the flag away. Nobody can ever use that flag again. These people with their freaking dog whistles, I swear. Like everything to them is a dog whistle. Like they know all of the motivations. If they see that flag, they know exactly what, they don't know what the flag means. They don't know the flag's history. They don't understand why anybody would fly it, but they totally know what it means when you fly it. See, because I think you're a Nazi and I can punch Nazis and that's okay. And so anything that you hoist up on your flagpole, that's going to be a Nazi flag because you're a Nazi, because I said so. These people are deranged. Newbie. A Republican, by the way, this is a story written by Kyle Ingram. This story is now taken off. It's going viral. It's on the national wires and stuff. People are picking, the left is picking this up. The media, I repeat myself, they're picking the story up because, look, this is another example of a judge who's corrupted by the Christian nationalist movement and the J6ers and all of this. Here's what Newby said, quote, until recently, we had no idea of the association of the Appeal to Heaven flag with anything other than its actual history. A history that reminds us to pray for our nation. At no point did we intend the display of the flag to be a political statement, only a statement of our faith. Charles Gay, a law professor at Indiana University who specializes in judicial ethics, said the act of flying the flag probably doesn't rise to the level of breaking any judicial code of conduct. Well, okay, then what are we talking about here? Oh, he says, it could endanger the perception of the judiciary as an impartial body. Well, if they flew the flag and nobody saw it, nobody cared, nobody even knew what the flag meant, didn't even know its history and its roots, but then you guys run out and do this story and intimate that there's something wrong with the flag and that there's some sort of a meaning behind the flag, dog whistle. Wouldn't that be endangering the perception of the judiciary as an impartial body? Because Newby was like, it was just the Appeal to Heaven flag. It's just the historical flag. But they got some pictures, you see. They got, somebody gave them some photos. They didn't want to say who they are, but somebody gave the News and Observer some photos of a flag from May 23rd, 2024. The day after the New York Times published its story on Alito flying the flag. That was the Thursday before Memorial Day. And so the New York Times posts the story about Alito flying the flag, and the next day the newbies at their beach house have the flag flying. While flying a provocative flag was carried by insurrectionists on J6 may not be a direct violation of the canons of judicial ethics, it certainly raises questions of judgment, said Representative Marsha Morey, a Democrat and a former judge. Right. Okay. So you're going to say that it certainly raises questions of judgment. Flying a flag. What about the American flag? Does that raise questions of judgment? Can I fly the American flag? Why not? That flag was flown all over the place at J6, right? By the way, a section of the Code of Judicial Conduct explicitly states that the spouse or other family member of a judge or a candidate is permitted to engage in political activity. By the way, also, another high-profile case involving the commission was made public last year when Justice Anita Earls, one of the two Democrats on the high court, sued this Judicial Standards Commission because it was investigating her comments that she made about how the courts are all biased. So that's okay. You can go and do public speaking engagements and rip on the judicial system, and that does not endanger the perception of an impartial judiciary. Telling people that the judiciary is not impartial, that's fine. But don't fly a flag from America's founding because people might perceive that this means that the judiciary is not impartial. These people are deranged. These people are deranged. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I could not do the show without your support and the support of the businesses that advertise on the podcast. So if you'd like, please support them too and tell them you heard it here. You can also become a patron at my Patreon page or go to thepetecallinershow.com. Again, thank you so much for listening, and don't break anything while I'm gone.